Welcome to the Grace Community Church Sermons Podcast. Each week we share the sermon from this last week's service. We hope this sermon encourages and equips you on your journey to know and follow Jesus Christ. Let's listen in now.
Well, we're going to be continuing our journey through God's big story and how you fit. And we're going to be specifically looking at the time here of exile. If you remember, we've been building up to this for several weeks, and we've seen how first the kingdom was divided, right? The Israelite kingdom was divided. There was a northern and a southern kingdom. The northern kingdom got it more wrong. They didn't have any good gods there that are good kings that led them in the right way, and so they were conquered first. The southern kingdom had some good kings that had periods of revival, if you will, kind of bringing things back, but invariably it was the next king, the son of the king, who led the revival that king took them back down the roads. And so we enter this time here, we saw where they were finally conquered. We talked a little bit about that, and this idea of Babylon was the final judgment coming in, and that's going to be the first thing we look at as Babylon comes in. Enacts God's justice or God's judgment, if you will, on the Israelites over three times where there was a siege and all this thing. And so basically then this exile, this period of exile, the 70 years that Israelites were taken everywhere, things were destroyed in the cities. And it could leave them wondering, right? I mean, even though we read there was prophets that were saying this was going to happen, but even in spite of this, God is still working. I can only imagine going through that as people of that day, that they would have been probably devastated, wondering what's going on and all of this. And today we're going to look a little bit more at this book of Daniel. And Daniel is an interesting book because it's kind of grouped with the prophets. And so you look at that, the canon of how it's presented to us in our Bible. But yet there's elements of it that's more narrative than prophetic. You know, we're going to look at specifically the first six chapters today and three different stories or accounts that happened to Daniel and a few other men. You probably know their names. And then there's the back half of the book where there is clearly some prophecy going on. There's prophetic things being said. Daniel's given visions about things that are going to come. And we're not going to dive into that at all today. But I just encourage you as we get through today and you see this first half of the book that you kind of continue that journey and read the second half of the book. And the overarching theme, again, which could be said about all of God's story, but specifically in Daniel, is this concept of God's sovereignty. The fact that God is in control. God is moving and orchestrating this upper story, like I refer to, his will, that is moving things along in the timeline that are coming up to when Jesus is going to come as Messiah. But today we'll stick with these first six chapters and talk about this exile. But we're going to talk about hostile rulers, people that kind of ruled with an iron fist. We're also going to talk specifically about four young men. And I say young because it's believed that they were in their teens when they were carted off to Babylon. And so you think about some of the things we're going to see that God did through them and how they lived their life. And it just harkens to when Paul's telling Timothy, don't let them look down on you because you're young. So young people, if you're here today, Drew, say hi to Drew. Drew's my buddy. Elena, over here too. Braden, wake up, buddy. Okay. I won't call out my kids. They're here too. But young people, don't ever think God can't use you in mighty ways. God is able. And what he's looking for is faithful obedience. And I've seen plenty of young people over the years that have captured that idea and have lived wholly for him. Not holy, H-O-L-Y, but holy, like as your whole self. And God is able to do amazing things. But the first section we're going to look at a little bit here is just Babylon. What, you know, telling you just a brief little bit about him, Nebuchadnezzar, this king that is in charge of that time and a very feared man. We're going to look at how God's going to use this foreign nation, pagan nation, to make his story move along. And so the southern kingdom, like I mentioned, was the last standing kingdom, and Babylon actually sieged them three different times. And before, finally at the end, where they destroyed much of the city, And in the midst of this, you might remember a king, Josiah. I've mentioned him before. We didn't really talk too much in depth, but he was a good king, a king that came to power at a very young age, but was one of the, you know, we mentioned that they found the book of the law, right? So he then tried to follow that book, God's word, to the best of his ability. But even in the midst of that, there was things going on. And so God is working through that. Well, Josiah is killed somewhere about 609, and Nebuchadnezzar in 605, about there, that time period, the first exiles were taken away. And this is when most historians or Bible scholars would believe that Daniel and his three buddies, who we know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were likely taken away. But let's capture this in Daniel chapter 1. Okay, we're going to be pretty much in Daniel today, the first chapter, the third chapter, and the sixth chapter. If you don't know where this is at, you know, we were looking at Jeremiah and Lamentations a little bit ago. Remember, if you kind of open your book, Bible, to the middle, you'll probably land in Psalms. Keep going, like flip your right pages over. You'll pass like Isaiah and Jeremiah, and then quick looking as you get to Ezekiel, and you should find Daniel there. If you get to some of the other prophets after him, like Hosea and stuff like that, then you got to go back to it. But anyhow, Daniel chapter 1, this is the first four verses. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim of Judah into his hands, along with some of the articles from the temple, those he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia, and put in the treasure house of his God. Verse 3, then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of the court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, and well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and the literature of the Babylonians. Well, let's pause there for a minute. So this would have been a common thing to think about. You know, a king was conquering a land or besieging it. He would take kind of the leadership, right? We've mentioned this before. The leadership, the young rulers, those that maybe were rising as the cream of the crop, the valedictorians, those that are scholars, those that are leading as young people. And they would take them to their country, and then basically, I'm just going to call it what it is, they brainwash them, try to instill their culture, the Babylonian culture, into them. And there's a couple of reasons why. I think probably the biggest one is if you take the leadership out so many times, the rest of the people just kind of follow along and will kind of go with that. But also, you know, in bringing these other men in here, it's bringing them into your culture. And in theory, if you can train them well or brainwash them well, you can have them be good and be helpful in your kingdom as well. And so these would have been the best, the brightest, the schooling. Interesting, this language that would have been talked about then with Aramaic, so that probably sounds familiar. And four of these men, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who were renamed by the Babylonians to Belshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Four teens removed from everything they knew, taken to a strange land, and had no idea what God was about to do. Well, in the midst of this, we see that these men were strangers in a foreign land. And this is a concept that you probably have heard in the New Testament. And in 1 Peter, and you don't have to turn there, but 1 Peter chapter 1, Peter is writing about this idea too. And he's writing to the church, but he says, to God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who have been chosen according to the full knowledge of God the Father through the sanctifying work of the Spirit for the obedience to Jesus Christ and the sprinkling by His blood. Now, Peter, I just want you to capture those first few words at the beginning, to God's elect strangers in this world. And so Peter is reminding the early church, and the reality is if we think about this, we can relate a little bit, or we should be able to relate a little bit to Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that we too are spiritually speaking strangers in a foreign land. I don't know if you've ever had this phrase come to your mind recently, but you just look around at what all is going on in the world and you're just like, oh my goodness, what in the world happened to the world? And the reality is the world has been a mess since sin entered, But we as believers in Jesus sometimes have our eyes kind of open to these things that are going on. And we too are spiritually considered to be strangers. Or Peter says in chapter 2, we're aliens living in a foreign land. And we too should be living lives after God's agenda. And so what we're going to see with Daniel, back to Daniel and his three friends, is that they are going to be doing exactly this. We can learn so much from how they conducted themselves to how they lived out their faith, and how they, there was clearly some solid teaching and upbringing that went on, because these men are tremendous examples of what it's like to follow God in hostile situation. They were absolutely facing persecution. They were far away from home, and they were be expected to fit in to Babylonian way. However, they chose faith in God over that. And so Israelites and the people here, and these four men specifically, are now in Babylon. And so we're going to spend the rest of our time looking at three stories that I have a bet, if you've been in church at all, you've heard of them. But I hope that we can look at these accounts with fresh eyes, with some of these questions and statements that I have. So in the first story, we're going to be back in Daniel chapter 1, picking things up in verse 5 in just a minute. But the question I want you to put in your mind right now is, does your diet match God's diet? And notice I've got diet in quotes there. I'm talking about food, sure, but I think you'll catch what I'm getting at in just a minute. At least I hope so. Hopefully I communicate that well. But starting in verse 5, let's read this account. Daniel chapter 1, verse 5 says this: "The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after, they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief officially gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and Azariah, Abednego." Maybe I'll employ the VeggieTales, Rack, Shack, and Benny, or something like that, right? So maybe, anyhow, those four guys that you know, we're talking about Israelites in foreign land. Verse 8, "But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. He asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel." Verse 10, "But the official told Daniel, 'I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than any of the young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you.' Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, 'Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the other young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see.' So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel understood visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians, enchanters in this whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus." Whew, there is some good stuff going on here, but let's jump back to the beginning. So they're brought in. Of course, part of this indoctrination, if you will, is that they're going to make them Babylonian all the way through, and part of that is making them eat the food that they eat. And, you know, this would have been against their dietary restrictions. Clearly, Daniel's saying, "I can't do this. This is going against God." But what's interesting to me is, even though they refuse to eat the diet, I love what he says in verse 8. And let this bring wisdom to our hearts. He asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Oh, you got to understand, this is a tremendous understanding. So many times, this is not a quality of young leaders that they young people in general, they just want to rush right in. It's like, I know the right answer, coach, put me in. I want to do this. I just want to rush in, kind of head down like a bull in a china shop. And Daniel is understanding here that sometimes you get more flies with honey than vinegar, right? You know, I think in the end, regardless of what happened, Daniel was clear about what he was going to do. He wasn't going to eat that food, but he trusted God through this process. And they realized that as they went through this, lo and behold, shock, surprise, they were blessed and they were coming out on the other side in better shape, better health physically than the other men. While they lived as strangers, they believed in God and they honored him with their obedience. And because of that, God continued his work in them. Now, I'm not going to say if Daniel failed that God wouldn't have done what God was going to do. God was going to do what God was going to do. But the amazing part about following him is that he gives us that same opportunity to walk in obedience with him. We get it wrong so much. We want to, you know, and I'm the same way. I sometimes keep spreadsheets and checklists. Anybody do that? Like, oh, all right, I'm going to start a workout regimen. So I'm going to write it all down. I'm going to do this on Monday. I'm going to do this on Tuesday. And I feel really good when I can check off Monday, check off Tuesday. Well, what happens when Wednesday comes and life happens and you don't get into it? Sometimes you get frustrated. And I realize that it's not so much about checking things off as it is meeting the goals that are put before me. God is asking us to be faithful and obedient. So many times we want to do good things for God, and that's commendable. And in fact, we're called to do the works that he's given to us to do, but it's not about the works. It's about the obedience, and that's a big thing we can walk away from this, as Daniel was giving us, and the three others were giving us a tremendous reminder about being obedient. So let me take this a step further and ask you that question again. Does your diet match God's diet? Now let's expand this. How about our bodies are living sacrifices. How are we doing with taking care of those? Those are important things to consider. But I want to introduce some other things that may be more of a problem or more of a struggle or more of an area that our diet is not matching God's diet. How is our financial diet matching God's financial diet? How are we doing with stewarding the things and the gifts and the talents and things that he's given us and using them for his glory? Maybe this one speaks home. How is our media diet doing? I shared on my podcast a couple weeks ago this challenge, and no one questioned me about it, so maybe no one heard it. So let me say it again. When we think about in this season, especially this political season, which tends to suck us in and we want to know more and more and more, is our Bible reading diet equal to or greater to our media diet? How are we consuming? What are we consuming? Is this causing a problem in our life? Is this leading us directions we don't want to go? Or is this even just moving us just one tick off of where God is having us? And as you know, if you've been in construction or any kind of design work, if you're off just a fraction here, suddenly when you get down the road, 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you are so drastically far off from where you're intending to be. So let me challenge you there. Is your media diet matching God's media diet? How about this? How about gossip? How about talking about other people? I think so many times we as believers don't mean wrong. Like, we want to know what's going on in people's lives so we can pray for them, right? But sometimes maybe it goes a step beyond that. How is our gossip diet doing? You name it, whatever what might be poking you right now, God might be bringing to your attention, write it down and give it to him in prayer. But we can learn a lot from these four men as it applies to how they live physically, but more importantly, how they live obediently following God. And what's interesting to me about this is that they didn't stop and think about it, right? The text tells us that Daniel heard that and he said, we can't do this. That implies to me that there's some things set up in their life, some pillars, some faith pillars that they knew ahead of time that they were going to act in certain situations. And that's so critical in our lives. What I ask you today is last time is ask the Lord, are your diets and your life matching how He would prescribe us to live. Secondly, the second story, and one that's really probably one of my favorites of all time, is in Daniel chapter 3. This one is, I just put the phrase, putting your allegiance to the test. Putting your allegiance to the test. We realize that we say a lot of times, I'm for this, or I believe in this, or I would die for this, right? But then sometimes in that moment when the testing comes, we waver a little bit. And we see some tremendous example here of the Holy Spirit working in these men. So let's turn to Daniel chapter 3 if you want to follow along with me in there. Remember King Nebuchadnezzar, who was king over the whole region and quite honestly seemed to have very much a fear factor with the other countries around him. In fact, you could even say that perhaps he had a bit arrogance about him. He makes this massive 90-foot statue, right? He's going to make this big golden image and said, all right, everyone's going to bow down before me. It takes a lot of gall to do something like that. You must have a lot of people telling you. But he believed it, and so that was the idea. He said, all right, here's what's going to happen. When this is up, there is a decree. When you hear the music, when you hear the call, when you hear whatever the call was, you are immediately to bow, okay? So he's doing this, and obviously there's some forces working within his kingdom too, I believe, and there was the three men again who are now referred to as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, same guys, just going by their Babylonian name. Well, they're in a place around that where that statue, and there's a call to bow down. And just like they did with the food, where they said, we can't do this, they did the same thing here, and they did not bow down. They refused. In fact, they were seen, and some people tattled on them. I call it tattling because that's what it really was. It was people jealous of them, for sure, and their stature and where they were at. And they're like, aha, I'm gonna get them. The king said, you must. And so he goes to the king, and they tell them that this happened, and the king is furious. And in chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, we see this. And Nebuchadnezzar said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? And so they have this choice, right? I kind of think, too, that they're brought in. They weren't immediately thrown in. So I kind of feel like there's like this tinge in Nebuchadnezzar. It's like, these guys have been pretty amazing, my kingdom. I don't really want to do this, but if you don't do what I told you, we're throwing you in the fire. Fire that's hot enough to consume the guards that were about to throw them in and would have, in any other situation, totally annihilated them. Continuing in verse 16, it says, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. Then one of my favorite verses, but even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up before us. You imagine the tenacity that these men had. I mean, I'm imagining they're not, I don't think they're screaming. I don't get that picture. I see them up there just resolute, confident. And they said, our God will save us. And then they follow that up. Even if he doesn't, we recognize that we serve him and not you. And let that one just sink in. You talk about allegiance. You talk about being put to the test. You talk about being questioned. It kind of makes some of the things we deal with right now, at least currently, that we consider persecution in America. And there's certainly an underbelly of sin and corruption and all those things that are happening for sure. But the last time I checked, at least not yet, we don't have people busting through the doors shooting the pastor on site and scattering the rest of the people, like a lot of the country. And it makes sometimes I'm almost, if I'm being honest with you, kind of ashamed that I kind of cower at the opportunities that I have. And this verse is just give me an idea of what it's going to be like, what it will take to stand for him. So he stokes the fire. Nebuchadnezzar, you know, stokes it even hotter than it normally is. And like I mentioned, it's so hot that the men, the guards that were assigned to throw them into fire, die instantly. And something happened that the king did not intend to see. In verse 24, let's see this. So the men are thrown in, the soldiers die, and this is kind of what he says. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 24, leaped to his feet in amazement and asked the advisors, "Weren't there three men who we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound, unharmed, and the fourth man looks like the son of the gods." Verse 26, Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was their hair on their head singed. The robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said this, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him, and they defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, and no other god can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Man, doesn't that just get your fire going? Doesn't that just capturing the power of what happened in this moment, the king that was so much against that God, the God, throws the men into the fire and goes, "Oh my goodness, what is happening? There's an angel in there," and you know, I think probably it very well could be Jesus in there as well. It doesn't really matter, but it's they're saving them and bringing them out. And how many people have had campfires recently and can still smell the smoke on the clothes you were wearing, right? I mean, even such a small detail like that is profound. That smoke smell just permeates, and there was no smell. And then Nebuchadnezzar says, "That is God." I don't think he fully understands it. He recognizes that's God and how powerful he is, and says, "Anybody who goes against them, I'm going to be the one that delivers this justice. You know, I'm going to cut them into pieces." And I'm not sure that's a great way to go, but you understand why he felt that way. He was so blown away on what happened here, putting their allegiance to the test. How does our allegiance to Christ line up with this? Finally, the last story is going to be in Daniel chapter 6. The question I have for you is, how strong are your convictions? You know, there's a lot of twists and turns, and interestingly enough, this just tells you a little bit about Daniel, actually a lot, that, you know, as I mentioned, when a king would come in and conquer and a different region would come and take control, typically they'd wipe out everybody, right? But Daniel, it said, has kept in multiple kingdoms along the way and various leaders in different cultures. And so Daniel always rose to the top, and that's where God was having him. And so Daniel, again, in this story, this account in Daniel chapter 6, there's a lot of twists and turns, but God keeps providing. God keeps providing for him, and Darius is now in charge, a different king, and Daniel continues to rise in leadership. And because of Daniel's success, I can relate, I can understand, others felt jealous of him. In fact, they were so jealous that they tried any way they could to say, "All right, we're going to find the dirt on Daniel," right? And just look at our political landscape today. I mean, don't dwell there long because it's a mess, but they dig up things of people that they, mistakes they made or things they said from decades past. And I'm not saying those things don't influence us, but I can tell you, as one sitting here today as 46 years old, that I'm a very different man than I was at 22. And I may have said some foolish things that if anyone found out about them, I can't remember any, of course, because God helps your memory to wipe it away, maybe. I don't know. But there's a good chance I did stupid things when I was in college that if you heard about, you'd be like, you know. So I just want to preface that with saying that Daniel then, they said, we're finding Daniel. He's been in service and leadership for all this time, for many, many years. We're going to find the dirt. Well, guess what? They couldn't find any. It was a abrupt approach. There was no dirt to dig up. So what did they do? Well, they decide to create their own plan to make the dirt. And so they got with the king and they said, you know, listen, make this decree. Make this decree that nobody for the next 30 days can pray to anyone but you, O king. And the king's like, sounds pretty good. I'm okay with that. Not fully taking into account that I'm sure Daniel was very clear about who he prayed to. And, you know, obviously it was public because these other people knew. But anyways, this decree is made. And the other encouraged the king to say, all right, this is what's going to happen. We're going to throw you in the lion's den if you do this. Well, Daniel being Daniel does this. Daniel chapter 6, verse 10 and 11 says, now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, catch this, he went home in his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knee and prayed, giving thanks to his God just as he had done before. You talk about convictions. Daniel knew that that was what was right. He was praying to his God and he was doing this in a public way. He didn't hide. He went up to his window. It's likely elevated. Windows are open. He's facing right the right direction, and he just gets on his knees and prays, continues to do this three times a day. The other men go, aha, I got him. And so they realize what's happening, and they turned him in. King Darius is very dismayed, kind of a side note to this, in much the same way I think that Nebuchadnezzar responded initially. He's responding in a way, goes, oh man, I didn't mean it for Daniel. You know, I don't want this to happen. But lest behold, he had signed this decree. It was to be happening. And so he does this. He has to put Daniel and throw him into the lion's den as was demanded. But the next day, we see some miraculous event happen. Just a kind of an understanding, if they had these lions in there and they were using it as a form of punishment, there was probably a really good chance that they were not treating them great, maybe not feeding them a lot, so they were kind of hungry and ferocious and ready to attack. And so when anybody was thrown in, let's just say they had lunch. They devoured. That was what they did. That's what animals do, left in their own primate form there. And so they expected this to happen. They covered up, but they realized that on the next day, they come and find something quite different. Daniel, in fact, is still alive. Daniel was saved by a miracle, by the Lord. In fact, it says, you know, kept the mouths of the lions closed. Darius then sees and kind of captures full, just like Nebuchadnezzar to a point. He goes, oh my gosh, I believed in Daniel already, but God is clearly at work here. And so he kind of reverses this on the people that told him to do this decree, throws them in the lion's den, and now the lions responded how they would have expected, unfortunately, and they were dismayed. Daniel obeyed. He lived out God's agenda in his life. And at the end of chapter 6, starting in verse 26, we see that we read this earlier. This was another king, another pagan king, that saw what God did and recognized who God was. Verse 26, I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and he endures forever. The king will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So, verse 28, Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. How strong are your convictions? So as we wrap up here, the natural response is then what does this mean for us? What does this mean for us? Remember, does your diet match God's diet? Do the things in your life and the way we're living match what God has called us to live? Where does your allegiance lie most? And finally, how strong are your convictions? Earlier I mentioned 1 Peter, and just a little bit later in chapter 2, we see that we are also, as believers in Jesus Christ, as followers of God, we are too strangers in this world. And we're just passing through. And sometimes things are easy, sometimes things are not, sometimes things don't make sense, sometimes they do, but we realize and we recognize that in this world we are just passing through, and the one mission we're given is to live on point for Jesus Christ, to bring Him honor and glory, to serve Him with all of our being, and to take the gospel to all the nations and let our lives be a reflection of His glory and grace and not our own sinfulness. And in 1 Peter chapter 2, these verses 11 and 12 said this, Peter's saying, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day He visits us." See, just like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we too are foreigners in this land, and we are called to live on point, on purpose for Jesus. He's got a plan for each of our lives, and it's about bringing Him glory and taking the message to all the people. And so I just ask you those same questions again. Are our diet matching His diet? Is our allegiance to Him first and foremost? And are our convictions strong? Will they hold and will they stand the test of time? You know, I've had the chance to visit with Hank several times in the last 2 weeks, and I appreciate what Spencer shared earlier. You know, he's losing this battle with cancer, and the man has, every time I've ever seen him when he's able, he's sharing the gospel of Jesus Christ with every person that walks in that door. He recognizes and he's finishing the fight well. And you may not be close. You may have another 50 years. I don't know. But let me tell you this, there's nothing certain in this life. Tomorrow is not promised. There's nothing that we can take with us. The only hope, the only message we have that resonates is the hope of Jesus Christ. And let us be ambassadors for Him. Let us be messengers for Him. Let us be so bold. Let us be so on point that just like Daniel, people try to find things about you and they can't find nothing. There's nothing there other than reflection of Jesus. And, you know, we get stuck, again, I'll say this again, mentioned it earlier, we get stuck sometimes wanting to do things for God, and all the glory to Him, and if God's calling you to big things, I'll be your biggest cheerleader. But the biggest thing we can do for Jesus is be faithful and obedient to the message He's given us and to the calling He's given us. So as the worship team comes forward, ask yourself those questions. Does your diet match that of God's? Where does your allegiance lie, and are your convictions rooted in Jesus Christ? And as we sing this final song, as you get to your feet and prepare, we prepare to sing this final song, is "Yes, I Will." My prayer for you is coming out of this message today that you will say, "Yes, God, I will follow you 100%.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's message. If you want further information about Grace Community Church, you can visit us at gccofalliance.org. Also note, the video for this message, for this sermon, is linked in the details below. Have a great day.